Jamie Lee Grace. Welcome to the Natural Health and Sobriety Show on UK Health Radio. Hi, and welcome to the show. Thank you so much for the feedback from the last few shows that I've done on UK Health Radio. It's really nice to get your feedback. You can always find me on social media at Janie Lee Grace, and particularly a lot of interest in the piece, the interview that I did with Jill Mackay on how the brain works. I mean, we know this stuff, don't we? But it really is great to have all of this confirmed. The fact that, you know, we don't have to stay stuck. We can really genuinely use the kind of benefits of neuroplasticity. So that was a great interview, really great to be able to interview Jill. And I think you're going to love my guest today as well. Dr. Amanda Foo Ryland is an author, a TEDx speaker, and founder of Your Life Live It. So she does coaching, but she's had over 35 years experience working in human development, and she helps people to create what she calls unthinkable change. I love that idea, the idea that, you know, you can't even imagine how great the change could be. So I was able to chat to Amanda about a whole bunch of things, which do link in a little bit with the stuff that I did with Jill, talking about how we can look at, how we can use how our brain works to recognize our own patterns and make change feel easy so it doesn't have to feel impossible, how we can create that resilience mindset and how we do not have to be defined by a label. And of course, we talk a lot about anxiety and how we can overcome anxiety. So I really hope you enjoy the interview with Amanda. If this is something that you're interested in, if you are interested in coaching or you're interested in understanding more about how you can make behavior change, particularly, then do please check out what I do with the Sober Club, because I'm a coach and I also train people to be coaches. And while the emphasis is on positive sobriety, of course, it's about mindset. Of course, it's about actually starting to love and accept yourself for who you are. So I hope you'll check out the work that I do there as well. But right now, I really hope you'll enjoy this interview with Amanda Foo Ryland. Amanda, so lovely to chat to you. And I know that you're a fellow TEDx speaker, and you're just telling me how you got so many views. It's amazing, isn't it, when the old views notch up on the TED Talk?
It really is. It's happened quite quickly as well. I think the more views you get, the more views you get. It's kind of how it works, isn't it,
yeah,
really?
But, absolutely. Yeah,
fantastic, yeah. A fantastic way to, share those ideas.
So you've had years and years of working in human development and helping people with change and developing resilience. And we're going to talk lots more about all the other things that you cover. But just take us right back and share a little bit of your story then. I know, that things have not always been perfect and easy for you either.
No, I mean, when I started in human development, it was really with the Estée Lauder Corporation. So I became an executive around education. So it was all about, educating our staff in terms of customer service. And that, in many respects, allowed me to kind of climb into the world of, well, why do people think what they think, and how do buyers make a decision to buy? And so it was all about around sales. And then when I left Lauder, I decided I really wanted to learn how to help people with bigger things. So that's journey started in 2005, and I founded my company, Your Life Live It, in 2008, and just became really, and still am today, just a student of this, basically around neurology. And up until, I founded my company, and then I wrote my first book. And I think that came out in like 2012. And everything had been squeaky clean. I mean, other than get divorced, there was no massive curveballs that hit at all. But I'd already got the toolbox of kind of, how can we outthink anxiety, and how can we look at a situation that's pretty dire in a really positive way. And then the first curveball hit. And I just cycled from Land's End to John O'Groats. And I said to my mate, actually, a 65-year-old guy that I was doing it with, and I said to him as a joke, oh, well, we might as well climb the National Three Peaks as well. And then we've cycled the length and climbed the height. And he went, all right, lass, because he's from Yorkshire. All right, lass, we'll do just that. And I thought, oh, bloody hell, I can't believe I've said that to Malcolm. And so that's what we did. And when we finished, I then flew back to New Zealand, where I spent some of my time. And I just had a routine health check. And basically the left kidney showed a tumor the size of a golf ball. So, wow. You know, there I am as fit as I could possibly be and have been diagnosed with kidney cancer. So the kidney was removed pretty quickly. But what happened then, I just realized that this toolbox that I'd been helping other people with was really going to come into play. And I'd never been into hospital before. I'd never, you know, only to visit people. And so I decided to embark on it as an adventure I hadn't chosen to go on, but I was on it anyway. So I might as well look at it through adventurer's eyes rather than, you know, a cancer sufferer or a cancer victim or patient's eyes. Mm. And interestingly, that really helped me because when the anaesthetist came in the morning, she said, "Oh, I'll give you a little concoction to make you feel nice and relaxed." I said, "Oh, please don't. I've never seen an operating theatre. I'd just love to see what one looks like." And she went, "Well, that's a bit weird, but, you know, we'll do it." So I got to meet the team. Yeah. I got to learn that they were going to listen to, you know, Queen while they were operating. So that kind of changed everything. And, you know, 4 months later, I ran a marathon. And that was me kind of going, right, that cancer thing's done now. Like, that's, you know, that's me back to health. But if somebody had tapped me on the shoulder when I was in the day I came out of surgery and said, "A year tomorrow, your husband's going to die," and I said, "No, you've got the wrong person there. I'm the one that's been diagnosed with this disease." But a year and a day later, Keith died. And so, you know, again, it's like digging back into that toolbox and kind of going, "All right, well, what I need to be resilient because I can't just, you know, sit in a grey bubble and drink Pinot Noir. That's not going to be helpful." So I decided to kind of create, well, what is it I want in my life?
Mm.
I want to create some magic. I wanted to go to Burning Man. I wanted to live a life that was adventurous. And I knew myself well enough to go, I'm actually not a solo traveller. You know, I was with a hot fireman for 10 years, married for 5 years, then divorced. And then I was with Keith for 19 years. So I knew that having another partner in my life was really important to me. And this is when another curveball hit because I fell in love with a woman.
Which you weren't even expecting.
Not even expecting. And, you know, even my own mum said to me, "You know, love, you're not gay, you're grieving. It's a phase you're going through." And I was like, "No, Mom, I know what it is that I want." And and I've only had 3 long-term relationships in my life. They, you know, just happen to have been with men.
Mm.
And, you know, I'm not gay, I'm not straight, I'm not bisexual, I'm not asexual, I'm Amanda. And I just happen to have fallen in love with 3 souls attached to male bodies and then 1 soul that's attached to a female body. So even navigating that was tricky because, you know, long-term friends were like, "What are you doing?
Mm.
You know, you're not gay." Well, actually, I'm just me. So,
well, this is where it can be very interesting, can't it? When whatever's come at you, we all have to kind of work out. You know, it's that thing of, in our head, we're the big stick figure, you know, and everybody else are the little stick figures. But in their head, they're the big stick figure. but it's how much do we take on that they're kind of gonna impact on us? It's exactly. An interesting one. I mean, you obviously felt very, very strong in who you were and you weren't going to take other people's views on. Good for you.
You know, and it was a good experience because it certainly sorted out the wood from the chaff.
Yeah.
You know, we lost some friends that we thought.
I can imagine, yeah.
And we actually gained friends that we didn't realise, you know, would stand by our side. So it was a really interesting time. And I was very frank and open with Sarah and said, you know, this is not, I know that obviously I've lost Keith and I don't have a history of a relationship with a woman. But you need to know that I'm committed and that I'm not going anywhere and that marriage is an institution I really respect. So, you know, it wasn't very long before we got married.
Mm.
But yeah, so I think, in answer to your question, where did my journey in personal development start? It started off quite innocently and naively and a bit like, well, I'm a bit wet behind the ears. You know, I don't really have a life experience of them getting divorced. And then it just came fast and furious, even to the point of, you know, Sarah and I were due to get married on the 7th of July 2016 in Portugal at a vineyard. And again, we were doing a cycle challenge with Malcolm, our crazy mate, and we were cycling from Courchevel to York, all for charity. You know, it's like 100 miles a day for 10 days. And it's a really good way of making sure you can fit in your wedding dress, you know, if you kind of do that just before you get married. And on the last day of our cycle, we were in East Anglia, but, you know, doing the last 100 miles up to York. And we woke up to a bombardment of missed calls on Sarah's phone. And we just celebrated Sarah's mum's 60th, actually. She lived in Perth in Western Australia. And she dives every Sunday, and she would go diving for crayfish and, you know, bring it home for Sunday lunch. And just on this particular day, she was attacked and killed by a great white shark. And it was like a month before we were due to get married. And, you know, what do you do when you have that terrible, shocking information? We flew immediately to Perth to be with family, and obviously, you know, her celebration of life was held there, as well as also in the UK, because she was obviously from the UK. And Sarah, again, you know, she was like, okay, I'm going to lick my wounds for a while. I need to grieve. But then what has this taught me? And so, in what I do, what I encourage people to think about is, rather than this is life's happening to me, why has this happened to me? You know, why did I get cancer? And why did my husband get cancer? And, you know, why did he have to die? And why did my mum have to get attacked? Mm. What we say is, you know, life is happening for me.
Yeah.
It's a subtle change, but what it does is it allows you to go, okay, I don't like this. This is horrific. Mm. But what can I learn from it? And how can I grow from it?
Well, so there's a kind of an acceptance piece there, isn't there? But you're right. Sometimes we have to do the, you know, actually, I don't like this. This is completely shit part first, if you see what I mean, before we leap straight into the, no, it's all good. we do have to acknowledge, that none of us like negative emotions and grief and sadness and guilt and anger, and they're all things we don't like very much at all. But the interesting piece, of course, is that none of us are really taught to sit with those emotions, are we? We're not really taught, oh, okay, all emotions are welcome. It will pass. What tends to happen, as you well know, is that we become our emotions. So someone will say, oh, I'm just a really angry person.
Yeah.
Or, I'm guilty. Well, no, it's not that. You may feel guilty at the moment. Very interesting that life happening for you. I really like that. So it's this resilience mindset that you talk about.
Yeah, it's essentially what I think is a really interesting concept is that when we're born, you know, we're born with everything we need. We've got all the apps programmed, ready to go to navigate life. And I think as we start to get a curveball hit and another curveball hit, some of those programs can go a bit glitchy. Mm. And like you've said, you know, people, you know, I work with clients on a regular basis, on a daily basis, and clients will say, you know, oh, I'm really anxious. I'm anxious.
Yeah.
And I sometimes get quite provocative, and I say, "Oh, really? I thought your name was Sandra." So they're wearing the narrative, they're wearing the script, and it's not necessarily even their script. It might be the mother's script or grandmother's script, grandfather's script.
Well, so, absolutely, yeah. As you say, it's not necessarily always even actual curveballs, is it? It can literally just be the little thing the teacher said, the little thing the parents said that you've kind of soaked up and made it mean. You know, imprint something on you as to who you think you are.
And therefore it becomes immovable. So really what I do is I help people to realize that or view it a little like having an app on your phone. You know, if something on your phone's not working, you just delete it and then you find an app that works better. And so I call it neural coding. That's what we've registered it as a trademark, because we say essentially it's just a piece of neurology that's not serving you. We can delete that and then we can install something that better serves you. So somebody that does anxiety on a regular basis, it's just a program that's probably being learnt. It's learnt behaviour. And let's face it, it's quite a lot of secondary gain with anxiety. You know, people don't realise it, but if they're anxious and they don't want to do something, you know, they don't want to go to that party, or they can say, well, I'm anxious and I get some anxiety.
Well, then obviously the unconscious mind likes to keep us safe as well, doesn't it? Likes predictability. So, absolutely. I mean, I come across this a lot, because people who are, you know, want to make behaviour change in their life, you know, one part of them wants to feel brave and get out there and do something. But of course, the other part of them just says, no, just stay how you always are and then you'll be okay.
Yeah. And I think that point that you made earlier about, you know, it's not about just going straight to that resilience mindset and saying, right, what, you know, life's happening for me. Absolutely. In all of those situations, you know, when being diagnosed with cancer and losing Keith, there's a moment where you have to go, I am going to just, you know, feel sorry for myself,
yes,
and
exactly,
in my gray zone and stay safe and cry and get angry and universe, why this? Mm. However, I think it's just useful to know that the longer we stay there, the more disempowered we are.
Yeah.
And therefore it means we have a choice. Whereas I think unfortunately a lot of people don't necessarily realize we've got a choice and we don't have to stay in this grave.
Yeah, exactly. I love that. I do some work with family constellations, which I'm sure you know about. And one of the fantastic kind of expressions we use there is, you know, you don't have to stay stuck, right?
Yeah.
But so many people do, don't they? They either because it feels too scary, or because they genuinely don't know yet that you don't have to stay stuck. It is a choice.
Yeah. It is a choice. And I think, you know, what I love about when I work with clients is I always say to them, you know, you're doing the change in all we're doing is holding the remote control.
Yeah, yeah.
You're the one that's making the changes. And it just absolutely fills my heart when people make a really significant change to themselves.
Yeah,
and it can be as simple as realizing, oh, my God, am I creating the anxiety? If I'm creating it, then I can uncreate it.
Yeah.
I can do the opposite. And it's like, yes, you can.
Yeah.
You know, you have got the power and ultimately you're a genius. We just forgot that.
Yeah, exactly. You know, tell me a bit about the about labels, you know, what you call label-less living. I know your TEDx talk was about labels. Tell us what you mean by that.
I think it was really interesting that when I was diagnosed with kidney cancer, immediately there's a label that comes
back. Yeah, I can imagine, yeah.
I was
a sufferer, you know, yeah.
Yeah, cancer sufferer, cancer victim.
And also you become a number if you're in any kind of system. Yeah.
Yeah. And some of that, you know, some of that serves because it means they know what needs to be prescribed and the protocols that they place. But even I noticed that what would happen is people didn't really know what to say. They really wanted to help. And so they kind of give me books or send me a link about, or, you know, one lady even said to me, and I mentioned this in the TED talk, she came to see me out of the goodness of her heart, and I didn't know her very well, and brought me some Pinot Noir and some fudge, and sort of sat there in the hospital and told me, you know, we made small talk, and then she said, I watched this documentary, Amanda, about this lady that had given a kidney to somebody that needed it, and I said, oh, what a lovely thing to do, to be able to donate your kidney. You know, so you can live with just one kidney. But what happened about 4 months later was she slumped into a deep depression, because apparently when the body loses an organ, and I'm sat there going, at what level is this supposed to be serving me? And sometimes people just don't know what to say. So what I found was I would literally cut in and say, look, the way I'm viewing this is I'm an adventurer. This is an adventure. Didn't choose to go on it, but I'm on it. So I might as well put it through adventurous eyes. And I'd literally say, I'm not a cancer victim. I'm not a cancer patient and I'm not a cancer sufferer. So I realized that these labels were popping up. And the other thing, you know, when Keith passed away was, it was, you know, I became a widow.
Yeah, yeah.
And people looked at me different. People didn't talk about the future. People were frightened to talk about it. And actually, nothing that they could say or not say was going to make me feel any worse than I already felt. Mm-hmm. You know, so I suddenly realized that these labels that we give, or society gives us, and people unconsciously put somebody in that category, it is really quite limiting. And I'm not against all labels. You know, one of our little boys, we've got twin boys that are three, Sarah and I, and one of our little boys is, we're celebrating that he's got some differences. He's got some differences in how he computes information. And we're celebrating that, and we're curious to see what journey he's going to take us on. Mm. And therefore, you know, sometimes labels are helpful because we're able to then know what help we need to get.
Yeah.
How to support it. But certainly, you know, this thing around, you know, when I do a lot of speaking and I share the story about falling in love with Sarah, a lot of people come to me afterwards and say, you know, did you always know you were gay? I'm like, well, no, because I'm not gay. I'm not gay and I'm not straight. So I think what I do, and certainly what I'm going to encourage our boys to do, is to not be boxed in. Don't allow that to happen. Be you. and allow you, if we throw off all the labels, it means we can change our trajectory if we want to.
Mm.
And I think unconsciously labels will do things that are perhaps not so positive,
mm.
You know, that have a negative connotation.
Yeah.
Like we've just talked about, you know, well, I suffer from social anxiety. It's a label.
Yeah.
I'm a sufferer, and therefore that's part of who I am, and it's true.
Yeah, absolutely. And it just becomes, you know, as you say, it becomes your label, it becomes your story. I mean, I hear this all the time, you know, with people who want to ditch the booze or want to make some kind of behavior change. They've got this label, and actually in a funny sort of way, it kind of keeps them safe. So as you say, mm-hmm. there's a secondary gain there. It keeps them safe if they can keep that label of, oh, well, it's a genetic thing, you know, it's in my family. Therefore, you know, I'm stuck with this. Well, actually you're not. you can choose. But it takes, you know, it takes a little bit of courage and a little bit of, as you say, you know, looking for the possibility, bringing that curiosity of how can you look at life differently. Yeah, I love this. I mean, there's so many things we could talk about. Tell us a bit about your new book, Knowing You, The Difference That Makes a Difference. Is that the right? Got that title?
It is right. And the draft came through. So this, I've actually got a copy in my hand.
Tell us a little bit about what's in there.
I've read a lot of personal development books, and I've worked in human development for, you know, over 35 years. And I think there's a key point that is missed. And what happens is, I think when people go on a personal development journey, really what they're wanting to do is stop pain. So they're wanting to stop the whatever those pain points are, but they are symptoms. They are symptoms of something far deeper. So this book is all about belief change. And it's all about taking the reader on a really simple journey to uncover what is unthinkable. They can't think it because it's running out of conscious awareness. It's running at an unconscious level. And therefore, I take them on a journey using case studies of real client experiences and some techniques that I use with my clients, and allow them to uncover what is that core limiting belief that they're operating that is the handbrake.
Mm.
And it's a journey of self-discovery. It's almost like the reader becomes their own personal Sherlock Holmes, their own personal detective.
Yeah, I love that.
And it is shockingly simple. It's the difference that's going to make the difference, because when it allows you to... Yeah, go
do
ahead.
You think that there is one, or do you think it's the many, you know, the whole wall we've built up over the years, or do you think it does all stem back to one?
I think what my work has shown me, and I've been doing belief change since 2005, and it's what we specialize in. And at Your Life Loop, we've got like 25 of us, and we all specialize in belief change because I believe it's the biggest bang for a client's buck. Mm, I really
absolutely
do.
I agree.
And what I've learned over the time is that beliefs have a hierarchy. So, you know, somebody will come to me and say, I'm not very confident. You know, I've got to do this talk at this Chamber of Commerce thing, and I'm really scared, and I'm just not a confident person, and I want to be more confident. Well, that's really at the top of the well, and it's a mm-hmm. symptom. Mm-hmm. So what I'm looking for is what is the real core limiting belief that that client's operating from? And they can't name it, and if they can name it, it's not it. Mm. It's just a symptom. And so, you know, I do believe there is a core limiting belief that's operating, and then these other beliefs spring up from that. And if we get right to the bottom of the well, or right to the root of the problem, and pull it up by the roots, then all the other symptoms disappear because we've got it right at the very bottom. So, you know, I was working with a client the other day in New Zealand, and she knew exactly that she knew there was a limiting belief operating, and her history told us that, you know, she'd been raised by a grandparent, she'd been rejected by her father and a mother, and she'd been mistreated by a grandparent. So everything was saying that she wasn't good enough.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, I'm not, you know, I know what it is, I'm not good enough. And I said, well, that's not it, because you can name it. So we went on this journey that I take the reader on. And in the end, it was, the limiting belief was, I'm totally unlovable.
Mm-hmm.
And when she said it, when we connected with what it was, she literally just was floods of tears. And I get the client to grade it on a 1 to 10, 10 being really painful. And she was like a 12 out of 10. Mm. You know, so we know when we've got to it because there's emotion attached to it, and it feels so true. Like, it's true, Amanda, that is true. And then it makes sense. And yet it takes bravery. And we've talked about that. It takes bravery to go there. It's a lot easier to work with the stuff at the top of the well.
Yeah.
So it's not actually what I think, it's what my work has shown me. Working with other people's unconscious minds, I've realized that, that if we just work up here in the hierarchy, the client's going to have to keep coming back and back and back and back.
Yeah, yeah.
I actually reference a client in the States that did that. He's written 5 books and he's a speaker and whatnot. And he kept coming back for little belief changes. And in the end, I just said to him, let's go big. I know it's scary. And, he's very kindly allowed me to feature him in the book and talk about that. So,
but when you get, when you mentioned your client who gets to that core belief then, is there usually, is the client usually able to know that it isn't true? Is there usually a knowing that that's actually not true? If you see what I mean.
Yeah, there's an education piece behind it. So what I do is frame, when I know I'm doing belief change work, which is most of the time, I always frame it up for the client. So I say how they were installed before the age of 7. You had no conscious awareness. It will have been installed by a teacher or a caregiver or a parent unknowingly. And so I explain where they come from. And I also give them a chapter of my first book, which is all about belief change, so they can read that, and learn from that. And then once they've named it and we've got it out, I ask them to do something that's a bit unconventional, but it really is a nice piece in that I ask them to notice every time the limiting belief comes up over the next 48 hours.
Yeah.
And just to kind of go, you know what? Thank you for, at some level, you've served me.
Yeah. Tried to keep me safe or whatever. Yeah.
Or pushed me because I believe I'm a failure. Therefore, you've pushed me to excel and create this amazing business or whatever. So I ask them to have gratitude and gratefulness around that and to kind of give it a bit of a nod and a wink and know that you're going to be parted quite soon. The company's, you're going to part company. So it's a lovely kind of, it's preparing the unconscious mind to release the limiting belief.
Yeah.
And then what I also do is get them to design the new empowering belief. So, the client gets to kind of design what that wording would be. And then I ask them to come up with what we call a drop down menu. So what are the symptoms of that? What are the positive symptoms of that new empowering belief? So they become an architect of their core empowering belief. And we literally just, we use neural coding. It takes about 25 minutes to half an hour. Delete the belief that no longer serves them and install the one that does.
Yeah, fantastic.
Yeah,
one really of the things powerful. That, yeah, absolutely. One of the things we talk about a lot, in the work I do with family constellations is, it's, we've all got this stuff that's happened to us, don't we? We all have the traumas and the stuff from childhood. But, it isn't what happened to us. It's what we made it mean. And obviously, that's what we do, isn't it? We make it mean something and then we keep repeating those same stories. So, yeah, I love it. Fascinating work. So what's next for you? So obviously the book's coming out. What else are you up to?
So the book's coming out on the 8th of November. And then I've just been shortlisted for 2 speaker awards in London.
Amazing.
So and that's on the 18th of November in London. So I've been nominated for Best Showreel as a keynote speaker and Best TEDx Talk. So
fantastic.
Yes. Sarah and I are going to hop on a plane and go over to London and get our glad rags on and go to the awards dinner, which is
amazing.
Exciting.
Wonderful.
Yeah. And then staying in this hemisphere and around February, I'll fly to New Zealand and do some work over there. So I'm going for about a month, hit the ground running, do a lot of presenting and connecting with people and running some courses and whatnot. So it means I've got to leave my gorgeous family for a month. They're all going to stay in Portugal. Mm-hmm. But that's what I'm doing. And then back to Portugal and then out of the UK quite a fair bit. So,
cool. Yeah,
lots of exciting things happening.
Amanda, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. The book is Knowing You, The Difference That Makes the Difference. I'll put the links to that in the show notes. Thank you so much for being my guest. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Amanda. And I hope you get to catch up again soon. And once again, if you're interested in finding out more about Amanda, you can find her work at Your Life Live It. And also just another reminder that if you're interested in the work that we do with the Sober Club, there's a whole bunch of stuff there around helping to build your resilience, particularly if you want behavior change, thesoberclub.com. And I'm also offering training
for people who want to become sobriety self-care coaches. The next training starts in January 2023. So just send me a message if that is something of interest to you. And don't forget, if you've ever got any suggestions for great guests for me, I'm really open to hearing them. I cover all kinds of things to do with holistic health and well-being, whether that's the spiritual impact, the physical, the emotional. I'm really interested in it all, as long as it stems from that place of that holistic approach. So please feel free to drop me a line if you'd like to recommend a guest. And I look forward to seeing you next time.
You've been listening to the Natural Health and Sobriety Show on UK Health Radio.